Welcome back to TRP.
Hi, welcome back to the Ross Lair podcast. Today I discuss Amelia Earhart, the myth, the legend, and the woman. Amelia Earhart was born on the 24th of July, 1897, 3 years before the beginning of a turbulent 20th century. She was born in the town of Atchison, situated on the steep slopes of the banks of the Missouri River, an hour north of Kansas City. She came from a well-to-do family. Her father, Edwin, was a lawyer whose main client was the railroad. Her maternal grandparents, Amelia and Alfred Otis, lived in a well-appointed and smoothly run household with servants and cooks, gardens and a carriage house. Who was this woman and why did she become such an icon in the United States? There are many varied reasons for that. Let me take you back. The family moved often and young Amelia saw her first airplane at the Iowa State Fair when she lived in Des Moines. Her life changed in 1920 when on a trip to California, her father paid $10 so she could take a demonstration flight. When I was 300 feet up, I knew I had to fly, she reportedly said. As a young woman, she held an array of diverse jobs ranging from stenographer to associated editor of Cosmopolitan magazine to truck driver, photographer, stenographer, designer of women's clothing and a nurse's aide tending to victims in the 1918 flu epidemic. 100 years ago this year, Amelia Earhart started taking flying lessons. Her various jobs helped fund her lessons with Netta Snook, one of the first women to earn a pilot's license. And with the financial aid of her mother in 1921, she purchased a second-hand plane, a yellow Kinner Airster, which she fondly named the Canary. She attained her pilot's license and was, in fact, only the 16th woman to do so. Within the space of a year, she had set a woman's altitude record of 4,267 meters or 14,000 feet. She would have many more notable flights, including the first woman to fly the Atlantic and Pacific. Oddly enough, in 1928 she achieved celebrity status, not as a pilot, but as the first female passenger to fly across the Atlantic. She was, in fact, in the company of two males, one being the pilot, Wilmer Stultz. This publicity greatly enhanced her reputation. Women looked up to her for inspiration. She could do no wrong and the commercial doors of world marketing and merchandising opened up to her. But in 1929, we had the Wall Street crash and the bubble burst. Yet somehow, she still managed to raise sufficient money to fund her non-stop solo flight in a Lockheed Vega B-5 across the Atlantic. All the more impressive when you consider this was the height of the Depression. This perhaps can be explained by the fact that by then Amelia had met George Palmer Putman, an American publisher, author and explorer. It was he who had published her idol Charles Lindbergh's blockbuster book We, which described his solo flight across the Atlantic and had catapulted him to superstardom, seen only by legends of the silver screen. The book became one of the biggest non-fiction books of all time, selling more than 650,000 copies in less than a year, and earning its author over $250,000. Because of his reputation for working with Lindbergh, he was contacted by Amy Phelps Guest, a wealthy American living in London who wanted to sponsor the first ever flight by a woman across the Atlantic Ocean. Guest asked Putnam to find a suitable candidate, and he eventually came up with the then relatively unknown Amelia Earhart. As it turned out, they shared many common interests: hiking, swimming, camping, tennis, riding and golf. After she completed her first flight across the Atlantic, Putnam offered to help Earhart write a book about it, following the formula he had established with Lindbergh when writing We. In 1927, Putnam's wife, Dorothy Binney travelled to South America and began a long, well-chronicled affair with George Weymouth, a man 19 years her junior. Putnam would leave Binney 2 years later. Many thought that George had left his wife for Amelia Earhart. This was not the case. He suggested he help her with her book about being the first female to cross the Atlantic, albeit as a passenger, and he suggested she move into his home to facilitate the collaboration. Though Putnam divorced Dorothy, Amelia declined his offer of marriage several times, but eventually accepted in 1931. But she included some strange caveats, clauses that were drawn up into a prenuptial that stated if the marriage was not working after 1 year, she could walk away. She also put no boundaries on her husband, nor did she want him to put any on her. She said it didn't matter how beautiful a cage was. To a bird, it was still a cage. This was to be a shrewd move on her behalf and helped further her career. Her husband had all the right contacts for sponsorship, publicity, and promotion. On May the 20th, 1932, Amelia set out in her Lockheed from Newfoundland, intending to fly to Paris. Nearly 15 hours later, she landed in Robert Gallagher's cow pasture in Ballyarnet in Derry, Northern Ireland. It wasn't quite the reception she had imagined, but nevertheless, she had achieved her goal. She was the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic. Mrs. Gallagher described that day, "We heard noise of an aeroplane about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Soon afterwards, we saw this great red monoplane above the house. It circled around a few times before it made for the big field at the back of the house and landed. Apparently, one of the farmhands who ran to the plane asked if she had come far. And Amelia, who did not seem too excited, said, 'America.'" Mrs. Gallagher described the pilot as a young girl in trousers with tousled hair wearing a long leather coat. "She didn't seem that enthusiastic, so I presume she must be hungry. She told me all that she had since she had left Newfoundland was a tomato juice." She stayed with the Gallaghers that night. The pasture where she landed is now part of the Foyle Golf Centre and the course's 14th hole. It's named Amelia's Landing, but the local players name it Heart Attack Hill because of its steep incline. I am sure Amelia was relieved to have landed safely after her adventure. But she was, I'm sure, fully aware of the missed promotional opportunities that had slipped her by not landing on an aerodrome in Paris. Still, it was an amazing achievement, and the papers went into overdrive, writing column inch after column inch about this remarkable young woman. Following Earhart's successful 1932 solo Atlantic flight, Putnam again organized her public engagements and speaking tours across the United States. Earhart joined the faculty of Purdue University College of Technology in 1935 as a visiting faculty member to counsel women on careers and as a technical advisor to the Department of Aeronautics. It was around this time that she began plotting to be the first woman to pilot and circumnavigate the globe in a plane. When you consider she landed in Northern Ireland, which is rather a distance from Paris, on her first solo flight, this was a given. So she persuaded Fred Noonan, an Irish-American, to take on the task. He was 4 years older than her and had vast experience behind him. He was an American flight navigator, sea captain, and aviation pioneer, who first charted many commercial airline routes across the Pacific Ocean during the 1930s. Following a distinguished 22-year career at sea, which included sailing around Cape Horn 7 times, 3 times under sail, Noonan contemplated a new career direction. After learning to fly in the late 20s, he received a limited commercial pilot's license in 1930, on which he listed his occupation as aviator. In the following year, he was awarded Marine License Master Class, the qualification of a merchant ship's captain. During the early 1930s, he worked for Pan American World Airways as a navigator instructor in Miami and an airport manager in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, eventually assuming the duties of inspector for all of the company's airports. In March 1935, Noonan was a navigator on the first Pan American Sikorsky S-42 Clipper at San Francisco Bay. In April, he navigated the historic round-trip China Clipper flight between San Francisco and Honolulu, piloted by Ed Musick, who was featured on the cover of Time magazine that year. Noonan was subsequently responsible for mapping Pan American Clipper routes across the Pacific Ocean, participating in many flights to Midway Island, Wake Island, Guam, the Philippines, and Hong Kong. In addition to more modern navigational tools, Noonan was a licensed sea captain and was known for carrying around a ship's sextant with him on his flights. By 1937, there was only a handful of firsts left to do, and the one she wanted most was to fly around the world, doing it the longest way around the equator. She had to make sure nobody did it before her. That time wasn't on her side. She was nearly 40. "It's hard to be old," she said, "and I'm afraid I hate it." Of course, she never did grow old. She never aged a day after July the 2nd, 1937, caught forever in a staggering last adventure that required superhuman endurance, consummate skill, and uncommon bravery. In a letter to Putnam just before her world flight, she seemed bent on absolving him of any responsibility in case the worst should happen. So it was to be on the 1st of June 1937 that she and Noonan set off on their adventure from Oakland, California. It was to be her second and last attempt to circumnavigate the globe. As was to be expected, the media was there in droves to see them off. Some reporters flew ahead to interview them on the progress of their Lockheed 10E Electra at many of the scheduled stops. Everything seemed to be going reasonably well. They had flown to Brazil, Dakar, Khartoum, Bangkok, Darwin, amongst other locations. On the 29th of June, the plane arrived at Ley, New Guinea. It is said that Amelia sent her husband a telegram. In it, she claimed about radio misunderstandings and personnel problems. Did she mean Noonan? Many books about Amelia Earhart have repeated stories alleging Noonan to have drinking problems. Some say he had been fired from his job in Pan American Airways for alcoholism. However, others claim that for the final takeoff from New Guinea, Noonan was so hungover that he had to be helped aboard the aeroplane. However, film of Earhart and Noonan boarding the aeroplane that morning show a bright and cheerful Fred Noonan helping Amelia onto the wing. It is one of the tragedies of Earhart's legend that an aviation pioneer whose contributions to modern air travel are considerably greater than Earhart's is primarily remembered as Amelia Earhart's drunken navigator. As to the real cause of their disappearance, we can only speculate. But one thing is certain. Aviation fuel became a major factor. They had completed at this stage 3/4 of their journey. All that remained of their adventure was a flight to Howland Island, and from there they would fly to Hawaii, and from Hawaii to the west coast of the United States of America and home. This was to be also one of their most difficult journeys. It was a trip of 2,556 miles or 4,100 kilometers, and they were looking for a small island in the middle of the large Pacific Ocean. In preparation for the trip to Howland Island, the US Coast Guard had sent a cutter, USC GC Itasca, to the island. The cutter offered many services, such as ferrying news reporters to the island, but it also had communications and navigation functions. The plan was the cutter could communicate with Earhart's aircraft via radio, transmit a radio homing signal to make it easy to find Howland Island without precise celestial navigation, do radio direction finding if Earhart used her 500 kHz transmitter, use an experimental high-frequency direction finder for Earhart's voice transmissions, and use her boilers to make the dark column of smoke a signal that could be seen over the horizon. Despite all this, all the navigation methods would fail to guide Earhart to Howland Island. During Earhart and Noonan's approach to Howland Island, the Itasca received strong and clear voice transmissions from Earhart, identifying as KHAQQ, but she apparently was unable to hear the voice transmissions from the ship. Signals from the ship would also be used for direction finding, implying the aircraft's direction finder was also not functional. The first calls were received at 2:45 a.m. stating the weather was cloudy and overcast. These calls were intermittent, breaking up because of static interference and the fact that the plane was still quite a long way away from Howland Island. Another call arrived at 5 a.m. It too was intermittent and did not seem to be a cause for concern. At 6:14 a.m., another call was received stating the aircraft was within 200 miles or 320 kilometers from the island and requested that the ship use its direction finder to provide a bearing for the aircraft. Earhart began whistling into the microphone to provide a continuous signal for them to home in on. It was at this point that the radio operators on the Itasca realized that their RDF system could not tune into the aircraft's 3105 kHz frequency. Radio man Leo Barals later commented that he was sitting there sweating blood because he couldn't do a damn thing about it. A similar call asking for a bearing was received at 6:45 a.m. when Earhart estimated they were within 100 miles of the island. Later research showed that Howland's position was misplaced on the chart by approximately 5 nautical miles. There is also some motion picture evidence to suggest that a belly antenna on the Electra might have snapped on takeoff. The purpose of this antenna has not been identified. However, radio communications seemed normal as they climbed away from Ley. One relatively new theory suggests that Noonan may have made a mistake in navigation due to the flight crossing the international dateline. However, this theory is based entirely on supposition and does not offer any evidence Noonan was impacted by or failed to adequately account for the 24-hour variance in his sunline calculations. Through a combined sequence of misunderstandings or mishaps that are still controversial over scattered clouds, the final approach to Howland Island failed. Earhart stated by radio transmission that she believed they were in immediate vicinity of Howland. The strength of the transmission indicated that indeed Earhart and Noonan were in the vicinity of Howland Island, but could not find it, and after numerous more attempts, it appeared that the connection had dropped. The last transmission received from Earhart indicated she and Noonan were flying along a line of position taken from a sunline running 157 to 337 degrees, which Noonan would have calculated and drawn on a chart as passing through Howland. Two-way radio contact was never established, and the aviators and their aircraft disappeared somewhere over the central Pacific Ocean. Despite the unprecedented extent of search by the US Navy, including the use of search aircraft from aircraft carriers and the US Coast Guard, no traces of them or their Electra were ever found. Despite 84 years having passed since the aviators' disappearance, new clues about their fate keeps appearing. Promising sonar images in 2013 showed a debris field now believed to be that of a shipwreck on the reefs of an uninhabited island, now known as Nikumaruru, in the Phoenix Islands, 256 nautical miles from Howland. Reports also surfaced in 2015 from descendants of an eyewitness claiming that he had seen an American woman with short hair and long boots and a man being held prisoner on a Japanese ship in the Marshall Islands, perhaps bound for Saipan. The bulk of the evidence has been compiled by TCAR, the International Group of Historic Aircraft Recovery, which now says it may have solved the riddle of Earhart's vanishing. In 1940, tiny fragments of what is believed to have been a human finger were found on the island of Niku Maruru, near the remnants of a campfire, along with an empty sextant box and a piece of a woman's shoe. Eventually, a British medical examiner on Fiji determined that the bones belonged to a male of European descent. Somehow, interest subsided. In 1977, however, documents including the medical examiner's reports were recovered and, at Teagar's urging, scrutinized by forensic anthropologists who decided that the recovered bones seemed consistent with a female of Earhart's height and ethnic origin. Although the bones themselves unfortunately vanished long ago, the medical examiner's report was re-evaluated in October 2016 by a forensic imaging specialist with particular emphasis on the forearms. This research revealed that the measurements were not only consistent with a woman born in the later part of the 19th century, as Earhart was, but are probably a near-perfect match for Amelia herself, judging by photographs. Whether or not this hypothesis holds up to future scrutiny, the mystery of Earhart's disappearance seems an inadequate explanation for the way she has held our attention throughout the decades and will most likely continue to. After 22 years of rigorous research and 10 grueling expeditions, we can say that all of the evidence we have found on Niku Maruru is consistent with the hypothesis that Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan landed and eventually died there as castaways, said Rick Gillespie, executive director of the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. Yet others claim that due to the lack of fuel in their aircraft, it would have been impossible to reach Niku Maruru, which was 265 nautical miles from Howland Island. Famed ocean explorer Robert Ballard led a 2019 expedition to locate Earhart's Electra, or evidence that it had landed on Niku Maruru, as supposed. After days of searching the deep cliffs supporting the island and the nearby ocean using state-of-the-art equipment and technology, Ballard did not find any evidence of the plane or any associated wreckage of it. Alison Fundis, Ballard's chief operating officer of the expedition, stated, "We felt like if our plane was there, we would have found it pretty early on." There is no doubt Amelia Earhart will always be looked upon as an inspirational young woman who broke the boundaries of possibility and showed women the world over that it is possible to achieve your dreams. But given all the mishaps on our final flight, I doubt she would be considered the most masterful flyer of her generation. Keep on listening to TRP.